This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
6 weeks ago, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said he thought the credit crunch would be contained. Use that exact word. Ben Bernanke went on the record this past spring saying the same thing. Since then, well, we all know what's happened since then, so it was surprising to see Paulson say essentially the same thing today, a day when a big British lender took a government bailout. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, representing America's public transportation industry, delivering 10 billion riders annually, and working for an energy-independent America. Publictransportation.org. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years, with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today. Good to have you here. It's the 14th of September. Northern Rock is one of the UK's biggest mortgage companies. Not quite countrywide big, but good-sized. Today, though, its foundations proved to be somewhat less sturdy than its name implies. The Bank of England stepped in with an offer of emergency credit, the first time that's happened to a bank there in more than 30 years. And perhaps just the latest sign the global liquidity squeeze might not be so contained after all. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Don't panic was the message from the British government today, but Northern Rock's investors and customers weren't listening. The company's share price fell by a third, and depositors besieged Northern Rock branches.
I'm feeling like extracting my money from this premises. That's how I'm feeling. That's why I'm here.
This is the sort of thing that happened in Germany in the 1920s. You don't expect to see this happening in London, in this allegedly well-regulated financial system here. It is disgraceful.
The UK finance chief, Alistair Darling, insisted there is no problem with the banking system, and Northern Rock isn't bust, he said. It's just experiencing a little difficulty raising funds. He blamed it all on the US.
All this stems from the problems in the American housing market. What's happened is there's plenty of money in the system. The banks have got money, but at the moment they're not lending to each other in the way they usually do.
The credit markets, where complex debt packages are traded and where Northern Rock does most of its borrowing, have been paralysed by the US subprime liquidity crisis. But, says opposition politician Vince Cable, Northern Rock is not an innocent victim.
They have been lending multiples of people's income well in excess of what you would normally regard as prudent, engaging in quite a lot of very marginal lending in order to increase their market share. Of course, all the British banks have been doing that.
More of them are expected to follow Northern Rock and go begging for help from the central bank. Earlier this week, the UK's finance chief called for a return to old-fashioned banking, with lenders and borrowers dealing directly with each other again. Instead, today he got an old-fashioned run on a bank and the first clear sign that the credit crunch could soon affect Britain's real economy. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Here's your trickle-down corollary. U.S. retail sales came in today with a disappointing report. The contract between the United Auto Workers and Detroit's big three car makers is set to expire tonight at midnight. Negotiations that began more than 2 months ago were supposed to have been wrapped up already. Instead, the UAW announced today Ford and Chrysler had voted to extend their contracts and that it singled out General Motors for special attention. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more.
GM is what's called the strike target or lead company. So the UAW will negotiate with them first and then use that contract to negotiate with the other two. Why did the UAW pick GM to go first? David Cole is chair of the Center for Automotive Research.
They think they can come to an agreement that has some reasonable ability to be a pattern across the industry.
A key part of that agreement will address health care. Together, the big three have health care liabilities of close to $100 billion. Harley Shaken studies labor relations at the University of California, Berkeley. He says if GM accepts a trust fund for health care, Ford and Chrysler probably will too. But he says the contracts won't all be the same. They'll be negotiated to meet each company's particular needs.
GM's context is a bit different, for example. It has four retirees for each active worker. At Ford, the ratio is closer to 2-to-1, and at Chrysler, almost 1-to-1.
Meanwhile, workers at locals across the country are getting ready to strike. But observers say a strike is unlikely because it would devastate both sides. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Teenagers eventually wind up driving some of those cars Detroit sells. There are restrictions on what their licenses and permits let them do, of course. No driving at night, for instance. And as of last night here in California, no cell phones, no laptops, no other portable gizmos. California is now the 16th state with electronic limits on its teenage drivers. Whether it might limit their insurance rates is another matter entirely. Here's Marketplace's Lisa Napoli.
There's a reason kids pay more for car insurance than adults.
Your first year of driving is the most dangerous year of your life.
That's Candace Miller of the Insurance Information Network of California.
When you add a cell phone or texting device to the fact that they're already a little challenged when it comes to driving, it only exacerbates the problem.
Nearly 20% of teenagers cop to text messaging while driving, and that's having an impact on the price parents pay to insure their kids. Typically, auto insurance has cost more for boys than girls, but Carolyn Gorman of the Insurance Information Institute says that's changing.
The gap is narrowing because girls are becoming more and more like their brothers.
Gorman says while laws can't legislate common sense, they seem to be having an impact. A federal study showed fewer people of all ages are using cell phones from behind the wheel, probably because they know they'll get busted if they get caught. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Take the Northern Rock news at retail sales. Could have been a car wreck on Wall Street today. Wasn't really, though. We'll have the details and we'll check in with the stockbroker from Dallas when we do the numbers. As that retail sales report I mentioned shows, competition is fierce out there for the consumer dollar, especially when consumer spending slows. So retailers have a big incentive to make sure their salespeople have just the right touch. Some of them use what are called secret shoppers, clandestine employees or contractors sometimes, posing as real customers. The Mystery Shopping Providers Association says it's an $800 million industry. Commentator Moira Mannion works in retail sales, and she says she's not sure all that money is well spent.
I passed my first secret shop with a score of 98%. This made my employer happy and praiseful. The score of my next secret shop was lower, 85%. Why? I had neglected to mention additional items for the secret shopper to buy in the airport jewelry store where I work. And points were taken because I hadn't known off the top of my head where in the airport a person could take her dog to poo. I did direct the secret shopper to a nearby information desk. I was counseled by my manager and district manager. My performance was lacking, they said. I was written up and given a warning that I had better improve. This struck me as strange. In only 2 months of employment there, selling high-end jewelry, which was something I'd never done before, I had become a top seller, often the top seller. I was always on time and never called in sick. I was reliable and responsible in a company with high turnover. One would think that this would be proof of my value as a salesperson, but the opinion of one person, a secret shopper, had cast all the rest into doubt. Recently, I had another secret shop. My score was 100%. Managers from other stores in the company congratulated me. As a reward, I was given a $100 Visa gift card, a recognition of service certificate, and a free lunch at TGI Fridays. Suddenly, I'm a valuable salesperson again. The thing is, my sales style has remained consistent. I know what works for me, and I've stuck to it. Yet I've received three different scores from fake customers. So what should I think? If companies insist on recording momentary impressions, they'd be wise to evaluate the skills of secret shoppers much more carefully before using them. If companies don't, they'll risk driving away good salespeople. I'm 100% sure of that.
Moira Mannion works at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Now's maybe not the best time to schedule a vacation to the Middle East. Ramadan started yesterday, which means daily life there will be slow for the next month or so. Still, places like Dubai are becoming increasingly popular destinations for Europeans. The region hasn't really caught on with American travelers, but some airlines, already well established elsewhere, would like to change that. And they're sparing no expense to do so. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Let's get one thing out of the way.
How would you say Q-A-T-A-R?
Qatar.
Quater?
Qatar.
The proper way to say it is Qatar.
That's an ad for Qatar Airways in its new service between Newark and Doha. It's joined Emirates Airlines and Etihad Airways to become the third carrier flying from the East Coast to the Gulf. The airlines already attract a loyal crowd of business travelers with jobs in government, banking and energy. But they want vacationers too. Joe Brancatelli runs business travel website joesentme.com. He says there's a hot party scene in Dubai, while neighbouring Abu Dhabi is building its own Louvre Museum. But he says the whole region is up against the common American perception.
I don't want to go there. That's the Middle East. There's a war every 5 feet.
The airlines focus their marketing not on the destination, but on their reportedly stellar in-flight service. All three aim firmly at passengers with a taste for the high life. Qatar Airways boasts a 5-star ranking from airline reviewer Skytrax. The airline's U.S. Vice President of Operations, Eric Pechstein, says first-class flyers never had it so good.
A passenger can go to the first-class lounge, sit at a table of four with colleagues, and wine and dine the entire flight.
And the red carpet doesn't run out when you get off the plane. David Field is with Airline Business Magazine. He says the three airlines are vying with each other to attract travelers by building some of the fanciest, most facility-filled airports in the world. Qatar Airways is spending more than $5 billion on its new Doha hub.
Each of the airports is the height of luxury. Each has luxury hotels. And the flights are timed and designed so that you could very easily have a stayover, a stop-off in the Middle East, and do a lot of shopping.
That stop-off element is important to the airline's success. Joe Brancatelli says many of their coach seats are filled by U.S. immigrants, traveling home via the Gulf to see their families in places like India and Southeast Asia. All three airlines want long-haul flyers who can't necessarily travel direct.
You're going to have to stop somewhere. So there's a huge competition, as well as we would like to establish ourselves as a world-class airline, a huge competition for where will you stop in the world en route to your final destination.
Right now, many passengers fly through London's Heathrow, which has become notorious for delays. David Field says each Heathrow horror story is a boon for the Middle Eastern airlines.
Because that's the competition. The competition is a person who was thinking of changing planes in Heathrow.
And who may now decide to make that connection in the Gulf. The carriers certainly seem confident that they can capture more world travelers. Middle Eastern Airlines ordered almost $50 billion worth of new planes this year. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with our stockbroker, business analyst friend David Johnson, who has mended his globetrotting ways. He's back home in Dallas, Texas. David, welcome home.
Putting in an excruciating 3-day week.
Yeah, you're killing me, right?
But, you know, it was a good 3 days. The market went up every day. Today, I'm telling you, the bad guys were in charge from the get-go, and the good guys, they squeaked out a victory. Right?
And how'd you do that? Because really, I mean, you wake up this morning, you check the news, and you're like, oh,
and it got worse. It got worse. The news coming out of the UK, the worst thing that you could hear, contagion. We're all worried about the subprime woes here, and here's Bank of England's got to bail out a big mortgage lender in the UK, and then we got downgrades on American Express. And oil, my gosh, oil closed at $80 a barrel yesterday. There was no way we could win today. This was, I'm telling you, this was a major triumph. Only 300 more stocks up than down. Volume was just frighteningly low, especially if you're a stockbroker.
Says the man who works on commission, right?
You're darn right.
Well, let me pose to you that age-old question then that I pose to you from time to time, which is what happened?
I just don't know. I really, this is, again, it's the great mystery of the marketplace. They know something we don't know. And I talked to you earlier. I talked to you the day I got back in.
Yep.
And I said, Kai, we can't have $80 oil if this economy is going into a recession.
Right.
I mean, you don't use the stuff. And that may have been what the market looked at. Or maybe the market's looking ahead at next week. Next week is just going to be jam-packed. We're going to get inflation news. We're going to get housing news. Maybe you've heard the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee.
I had heard that, yes.
Yeah, they're going to get together on Tuesday, so we see what interest rates and the economy, and we've got a lot of earnings coming out. And, of course, you know what's happening Monday.
No.
Monday's the big day. Greenspan's book comes out.
Oh, yeah, no, I know. But let's...
No, wait a minute.
What?
I looked back. I put in my order on it. I'm serious. I ordered it on June the 4th because I want to read it. You know, and I want to read the last chapter first because I want to see if everybody dies in the end.
Yeah, well, exactly. That sort of goes to my next point, which is come next Tuesday at 2:15 in the afternoon Washington time. What happens, you know, if nothing happens? Or what people don't want to happen happens?
Something will happen. For the market, something will happen. There'll be a clue in there about what they think about monetary policy or will think we do. And then we'll move on to the next thing. I mean, we've got inflation numbers that day. We've got more inflation numbers on Wednesday. We've got housing numbers coming out. We've got testimony by Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Paulson on Thursday. There'll be plenty of news next week, and the Fed will be a big part of it. I just hope not too big a part of it. I still think they're behind the curve. I think they were too slow to lower interest rates. But I'm telling you, today was... I mean, it's only 17 points, Kai, but I'm telling you, a major triumph.
All right. Leaving it, as always, departing the field and declaring victory, David Johnson in Dallas. Thank you, David.
Yeah, I'd come back and I'd play two today, I think.
Yeah, right, so exactly.
Have a good weekend.
You too. Coming up, baseball gets bankrolled in a big way.
If you have this wealthy market, hey, and you have the fan base, you can expand into these places, and it means a lot of dollars.
Honestly, we didn't plan that play two thing into that cut, but first, let's do the numbers. So it is the happy music today, but happiness is, of course, all relative. The Dow Industrial struggled out of a 100-point hole at the start of the trading day, ended up 17 points higher, a gain of 0.1%, closing at 13,442. The Nasdaq notched up a single point, a tiny fraction of 1%, to wrap at 2602. The S&P 500 up by a whisker, but flat for all intents and purposes, finishing at 1484. The weekly numbers look a whole lot better. The Dow average managed to climb 2.5% since Monday. The Nasdaq rose 1.4% on the week. The S&P 500 picked up 2.1% over the past 5 days. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Siemens, from strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com. Marketplace is podcasting. Marketplace Takeout is a mix of our best stories from the past week, the cream of the crop from our reporters around the world, delivered to you on the go wherever you are. Want to sign up? Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link at the top of the page. Or you can download entire shows of Marketplace and Marketplace Money at audible.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here are events for Monday, September 17th. Representatives from the EU and India meet in Lisbon to discuss employment and social policy. The Business Blog Summit gets underway in downtown Chicago. And on this day in history, 1787, the United States Constitution was signed. The 17th of September is federally designated Constitution Day. I'm Alex Schmidt.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are working on a special series that'll make it to air in November. We'll be looking at the U.S. consumer economy and whether or not it's sustainable for us to keep on buying stuff the way we do. It'll be called, appropriately enough, Consumed. You'll be able to hear it here and on some other APM programs. We've got our staff out doing the reporting for it right now, including Marketplace's Tess Vigeland. She's volunteered to spend the next 2 weeks hauling her household trash around with her. She's here to explain why, if she can. Tess?
Kai, I'm going to be carrying my trash around with me 24/7 for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's what I said you were going to be doing. So tell me again, what are you going to be doing?
Yeah, I'm kind of asking myself that as tomorrow approaches. But let me ask you this. Do you have any idea how much garbage we produce, you produce every day?
You, as in me, you?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't.
Have you ever looked? Have you ever kept track?
No.
All right. Well, let's start with this fact. The EPA says that we, you and me and the rest of America, generated 245.7 million tons of garbage in the year 2005. That is 20% more than we generated in 1990, and it is 179% more than we generated in 1960. Now, here's the kicker. The population has grown only 60% in that time, and our amount of garbage has grown 179%.
Right. Bring that down to get it back to you and me. Get it down to a you and me level, the personal level.
All right. Well, all that stuff that you spend your hard money on,
yes.
You know, the stuff that you buy for you and Stephanie, the three boys, mm-hmm. All the takeout containers when, you know, you don't feel like firing up the grill, those plastic bags that get filled during the dog walks. Well, all that adds up to an average of about 6 pounds a day. And of course, you have to add to that that there's all kinds of waste. In waste that happens during the manufacturing process, the delivery from the manufacturer to the retailer to your house.
And then on to the landfills, right, eventually?
Right. Actually, more than half goes to landfills. We recycle less than half of our waste. And the landfills are closing down everywhere. In fact, the biggest one in the country is here in Los Angeles, Puente Hills, about 20 miles from where you and I are right now. And it's closing in 6 years. So all that garbage will have to travel even greater distances using even more resources. Are you feeling guilty yet?
Yeah, I am. You know, I suppose a little bit. But riddle me this. What is you carrying your garbage around going to do about this problem?
Well, okay, so we're not going to solve the problem here. But, you know, I think a lot of us just kind of chuck our stuff in the garbage bins without really thinking about it. We go out in the dead of night to put our bins out on the street on garbage day. So maybe this will shine at least a small light on the problem, hopefully give me, everybody else out there who might be following the experiment, a really personal appreciation for what our consumption, my consumption, is doing to the planet. And the goal is to get down to zero waste by the end of 2 weeks. I have my doubts about that. We shall see. But until then, you're going to see me carrying my trash around the office, hoping listeners will join the effort here. And to do that, they can go to our website and click on the sustainability link and share some of their experiences.
Let me ask, before I let you go, a point of clarification or two. Now, obviously, this will be, you know, household solid waste, as you said. Does that mean, you know, coffee grounds and eggshells and the whole shooting match?
It means everything that I can't put in my backyard compost.
Ah.
I do compost for my lovely rose garden.
All right.
And we recycle a lot in our house. But, you know, there are things like chicken bones and fish skins that I don't know what I'm going to do with, and maybe somebody out there can help me out with that.
Let me put you on the spot here. What's your guess at the end of 2 weeks, how many bags of trash you'll be hauling around?
Well, we probably put, I would say, 3 to 4 a week in our trash bin. I'll be really happy if I can get down to one.
Yeah, the rest of us will, too. Tess Vigeland hosts our personal finance program, Marketplace Money. She's carrying her trash for the next 2 weeks. Thank you, Tess.
Thank you, Kai.
The Major League Baseball season's getting right down to it. With just 2 weeks left, every game counts, including the three that'll be played at Fenway Park this weekend. The Yankees go to Boston 5.5 games behind the Red Sox. Both teams will probably wind up making the playoffs. That's good news for fans. Great news for Major League Baseball. The Red Sox and the Yankees are two of the sport's biggest money-making machines, and that rivalry is headed overseas, as Marketplace's Nancy Fargali reports.
Listen to this. Let's go, Red Sox! Cheery enough, but not if you're the home team fending off an army of Red Sox followers in Boston gear. This year, those fans are attending more road games than any other teams. And in Angel Stadium in Anaheim, this 8-year-old Californian native pledges his allegiance to the Red Sox.
My dad's from Boston, and he kind of brainwashed me.
And don't laugh if you root for the Yankees. As a parent, you've probably done the same exact thing. Together, those teams account for almost half of the merchandise sales in the major leagues. All those caps and T-shirts make up a multi-million dollar brand market here. But Major League Baseball is now setting its sights beyond the U.S. In 1999, about 80 games were shown live in Japan. Now that number tops 400, including this recent Yankees-Red Sox game in the Bronx, where two Japanese players faced each other, Daisuke Matsusaka for the Red Sox and Hideki Matsui for the Yankees. Here's the play-by-play.
Well, about 55,000 pairs of eyes watching this matchup, and in Japan, an entire country. Matsusaka against Matsui. Bases loaded.
American baseball isn't loaded with Japanese players. More foreign players are from the Dominican Republic and Venezuela, but Japan has the second largest economy in the world and fans with deep pockets. J.C. Bradbury is the author of the book, The Baseball Economist.
If you have this wealthy market, hey, and you have the fan base, you can expand into these places, and it means a lot of dollars.
Japan is responsible for nearly 70% of baseball's foreign revenue. Jim Small runs major league operations there. He says it's the most important international market, and the trick is getting Japanese fans to care as much about American baseball culture as they do about Japanese athletes in the league.
If you have a team you follow, there's always a competition. There's always a rival. So I think just the nature of sports has made it easy for a Japanese fan to look at this Yankees-Red Sox rivalry and say, you know what, I get it.
But people in the know say Japanese fans don't necessarily follow U.S. teams. They follow their favorite players. Daigo Fujiwara is the founder of JapaneseBallPlayers.com.
Most of the media just report, you know, Matsui went 2-for-4 rather than Yankees came back in a dramatic fashion in the ninth.
This year, Major League Baseball ran an essay contest in Japan asking fans to pick between the Yankees and the Red Sox. Jim Small says one fan's response sounded familiar.
He said that I'm a Red Sox fan and not a Yankee fan because I choose good over evil.
And Major League Baseball is hoping he'll also choose to buy a jersey. I'm Nancy Fargali for Marketplace.
I think we need a little disclosure here in the spirit of good and evil. Nancy Fargali, big Red Sox fan. Me, in the spirit of full disclosure, Yankees fan.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, the credit crunch is bringing out bargain basement prices in the real estate market. And if you're lucky this weekend, you might just get a bargain, a basement, and a new house to boot. Homebuilder Hovnanian is holding what amounts to a fire sale in the 19 states in which it does business. Discounts and upgrades that could add up to as much as $100,000 in savings per house. Last week, the company reported quarterly sales were off 27%, so it's trying to offload some of that excess inventory. Wall Street liked it a whole bunch. Shares rose 11% today. You got to act fast, though. Sale ends Sunday. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 17 points, a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq up a point. Flat is the word we use for that. The S&P 500 also ended the day basically flat. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, navigating the stormy seas of music piracy.
You know, I told him, look, take my computer, look at that. I can prove to you I didn't do this. And he said, what do you guys expect us to look at everyone's computers that says they're innocent?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that on Monday.
A
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.